The Committee on Rules and Legislative Administration will come to order. A quorum is present. First, because we have a longer hearing and a full room, I'm going to read this message that we often read in committee hearings, welcoming you all to the Minnesota House of Representatives. We appreciate your interest in participation in the legislative process. To ensure that everyone can view, hear, and understand today's proceedings, we ask for your cooperation in maintaining decorum and civility throughout this hearing. For the safety, security, and comfort of all attendees, please note the following guidelines. As the committee chair, I will maintain control of these proceedings and establish the following expectations. Signs and placards are not permitted in the hearing room. Verbal outbursts, shouting, or disruptive behavior will not be tolerated. Applause or other audible demonstrations are not allowed. For safety reasons, standing or sitting in walkways or aisles or standing or obstructing at your chair is prohibited. If you require any accommodation, please speak with our sergeant staff, identified by gold ties. Troopers and house security personnel are present to ensure everyone's safety. Those providing testimony will be given specific time limits which must be strictly observed. If you receive an entrance ticket, please retain it as it may be required for re-entry if you leave the hearing room. Failure to comply with these guidelines may result in the removal from the hearing room. Our goal is to conduct these proceedings efficiently while ensuring everyone has the opportunity to observe and participate appropriately. The first order of business is the minutes from April 9th, 2026. Representative Scott, would you like to move the minutes?
I have thoroughly read the minutes, and I move the minutes, Mr. Chair.
Representative Scott moves the minutes from April 9th, 2026. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, nay. The minutes are approved. The next order of business is the calendar for the day. We are proposing calendaring 20 bills for the calendar for Monday, April 20th, 2026. 18 bills, excuse me. House File 2358, Van Binsbergen. House File 3453, Hansen J. House File 3496, Harder. House File 3593, Jacob. House File 3621, Cleavorne. House File 3629, Bonner. House File 3676, Nash. House File 3762, Witte. House File 3768, Curran. House File 3769, Curran. House File 3782, Moeller. House File 3825, Rapinski. House File 3826, Witte. House File 3827, Duran. House File 4425, Myers. House File 4133, Moeller. House File 4467, Bierman. And Senate File 3832, Nelson. I move the adoption of the calendar for the day pursuant to Rule 1.21 and 3.33. The Committee on Rules and Legislative Administration will designate Monday, April 20th, for the adoption of the calendar for the day and establish a pre-filing requirement for amendments offered to these bills. Is there any discussion? Representative Long.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd urge support of the calendar.
Is there any further discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, nay. The motion prevails and the calendar is adopted. Please note that under Rule 3.33, a pre-filing deadline for these bills is now in place. The next order of business is a bill in our possession that proposes a constitutional amendment, House File 3900. Representative Igo is the chief author. And welcome, Representative Igo. I will move that House File 3900 be placed on the general register. Be recommended to be referred and placed on the general register. Representative Igo, go ahead and present House File 3900. Welcome to the committee.
Well, thank you, chairs and members of the Rules Committee. This is a very exciting bill for the state of Minnesota and for its voters to hopefully make a decision on here this November. So the House File 3900 is a constitutional amendment that is working on amending our state constitution in regards to our school trust lands. So for a little background for the committee, our school trust lands were set up when we became a state as a way to pay for the public schoolhouse in each one of our communities. As time progressed, these lands were traded and moved away and have become consolidated, and what they create is revenue for the state of Minnesota. And that fund that has created revenue now sits at around $2.3 billion that is entitled to the education of every single student in the state of Minnesota. Right now, things have changed since the way in the past about how you manage school trust lands, how you manage interest, how you invest things to get higher returns. Because of that change, there was a task force that was passed by this legislature to look into the Constitution and think about how we bring this part of our Constitution into the 21st century. That task force worked all last year and brought us the bill that we have in front of you today. This bill would increase unencumbered dollars that each one of our school districts get from $68 to $95 a pupil upon passage. The best part about this bill, it doesn't cost the state of Minnesota a nickel, and it doesn't cost taxpayers a nickel. This is a way for us to look at the good decisions we've made as a state in keeping our school trust lands whole, and the way they've been able to continue to make investments for the state of Minnesota. We now get to go in there and fix them and make sure they're going to do what they were intended to do, which is fund public education. So, members, I would encourage support of the bill, but I know I do have two testifiers with me today. One, I have our director from the Permanent School Trust Lands, as well as SBI here, who can walk through a little bit more details about the process that went through with the task force and a little bit more history for the committee.
Thank you. I have on my list Andrew Kretsch, the deputy director of the Minnesota State Board of Investment, if you'd like to come forward and thank you, sir. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Chair Niska, and thank you, members of the committee, for having me here. My name is Andrew Kreck. I'm a deputy director with the State Board of Investment, and I was also a member of the Permanent School Fund Task Force, and I'm glad to be here today to give you some background on the work of the task force that went into producing the recommendation that you see reflected in the legislation before you. So I'm going to take a few minutes walking through a presentation that I think you all should have in front of you, and I might reference some page numbers as I flip through. So as background, as Representative Igo mentioned, the Permanent School Fund was established at the time of statehood of Minnesota in 1858 to create a permanent and self-sustaining source of education funding. Minnesota law, both statute and constitution, currently specify how the fund should be managed and the formula by which the amount available for distribution from the fund is calculated. And today, there are three state agencies that are primarily involved in the ongoing operations of the fund, which you can see on page 2 of the presentation. We have the Department of Natural Resources, who is responsible for managing the individual parcels of school trust lands and generating revenues from those land management activities. The revenues from those land management activities are then transferred to the Permanent School Fund. At that point, the State Board of Investment becomes involved. We take those dollars and we invest them in a portfolio of publicly traded, highly liquid financial instruments. The SBI is responsible for the investment management of that fund and for ensuring that the correct amounts are distributed from the fund. Those dollars then ultimately end up with the Department of Education, who is responsible for apportioning those dollars to individual districts around the state in the manner prescribed by a set of statutes that address apportionment. On page 3, you can see some of the background of the task force itself. We were created by the legislature in May 2024. There are 9 members of the task force, a designee of the Commissioner of Education, Daley Lehman, a member appointed by the State Board of Investment, that's me, 4 members appointed by the governor, Denise Dietrich, Tracy Fierick, Tracy Lotka, and Aaron Vanderland, and 3 members who are appointed by the Legislative Permanent School Fund Commission, who are Terry Spano Madden, Paul Peltier, and Julie Sandsteed. We were given a charge by the legislature to examine the historical returns on the Permanent School Fund endowment and evaluate and recommend potential changes to the distribution of earnings. Our task, and what we were commanded to do, was to examine school trust endowment policies in other states, and we were instructed that our recommended changes could address both state statute and state constitution. The task force members met together over the course of more than a year, from the fall of 2024 through the end of 2025, and we ultimately presented our report and recommendation to the legislature in January of this year. Now I'm on page 5. Early in the work of the task force, we started to coalesce around identifying some guiding principles that would guide our work. It's our belief as a task force that any recommendation that came out of that group needed to be aligned with these guiding principles. And they are, first, to maintain the permanent school fund as a perpetual financial resource, meaning that distributions from the fund must not unduly draw down the fund's balance or otherwise impair its ability to serve its purpose, which is to provide stable education funding in perpetuity. Second, we sought to establish a distribution policy that balances the needs of current and future students, meaning that the fund must grow in a way that preserves its purchasing power for the benefit of future generations while also serving its mission of supporting students in the here and now. Third, we sought to ensure consistent annual distributions. We wanted to find a recommendation that we believed would minimize significant year-to-year variations in distributions to school districts in an effort to support planning and budgeting activities by those districts. And fourth, we sought to find a recommendation that allowed for adaptability in investment management so that the State Board of Investment would have the necessary flexibility to manage the fund according to industry best practices and enable us to maximize the long-term value of the fund without taking undue risk. On the next page, page six, you'll see that the task force examined the current legal framework that governs the permanent school fund. And we identified that there are two major constraints on fund distributions that are in the state constitution today. First, distributions from the fund are currently limited to net interest and dividend income and exclude capital gains stemming from asset appreciation. Secondly, the Constitution indicates that capital gains and, if necessary, interest and dividend income must first be used to offset losses in the fund from prior years, which has the effect of potentially reducing or eliminating distributions from the fund altogether in loss recovery years. The task force concluded that the current framework has a number of issues with it. First, this framework unduly restricts fund distributions to only interest and dividends and ignores the benefit of capital gains, which, as we'll see in a moment, comprise the vast majority of the growth of the fund over time. Second, it creates an imbalance between the interest of current and future beneficiaries. Because the vast majority of the growth of the fund is in the form of capital gains, that benefit always accrues for future generations and is not used to support students in the current generation. Third, the loss recovery mechanism indicated by the Constitution could potentially result in inconsistent yearly distribution amounts. And fourth, because all of these restrictions are in the state constitution, it's very difficult to adapt to changing circumstances and to allow the SBI to manage the fund according to best practices. Flipping ahead to page seven, the task force then examined the historical returns of the fund, as was indicated to us by the legislature. And what we observed is that the performance of the fund has been very strong over time. You'll see that average investment returns over the past decade have been about 8%. They've been stronger than that in more recent years. And that's been achieved, again, with a fund that is entirely invested in fully liquid, marketable securities, highly diversified across common stocks, bonds, and cash, and in accordance with an asset allocation that's determined and managed by the State Board of Investment. In the next slide, you'll see that as a result of those strong investment returns and also as a result of land management revenues coming from school trust lands, the value of the permanent school fund has grown greatly over the last few years. It's doubled over the last 10 years and nearly tripled over the last 15 years. However, because of the constitutional limit on distributions to only interest and dividends, over that period of time, average distributions from the fund have averaged about 2.5% of the fund's value, as compared, again, with average annual returns from investment activities of 8%, in addition to land management revenues coming into the fund. On page nine, I'm going to preview the recommendation that the task force ultimately reached, and then I'll spend a few moments walking through how we arrived at that recommendation. Based on the task force research and analysis, we recommend amending the Minnesota Constitution and certain related statutes to manage the fund in accordance with the guiding principles that we just identified. The task force also recommends that the enduring principles and objectives of the fund should be articulated in the Constitution, but that specific operating details, such as the distribution policy, governance, and investment management of the fund, should be established in statute and not in the state constitution. and the specific recommendation in the report that the task force provided to you is that we recommend adopting a 4.5% distribution rate calculated based on a rolling 3-year average of the fund's market value. In the next couple slides, I'll walk through how we reached that recommendation. The task force spent significant time doing research and analysis on common policies and practices at other similar state funds, state school funds in other states around the country, as well as other educational endowments, so think college and university endowments across the country. Those college and university endowments, while not state-sponsored and backed by natural resources in the way that the Permanent School Fund in Minnesota is, they do serve a similar purpose in that they exist to provide support to their institution's educational mission in perpetuity. And in that way, their objective is quite similar to the Permanent School Fund. What we observed in that analysis, which was supported by research provided to the task force by two independent, nationally recognized investment consultants that work with the State Board of Investment, was that the central tendency of policies of those comparable funds was 4.5% of the average market value of the fund over the prior 3 years. The task force observed that adopting such a policy would have the effect of balancing the Permanent School Fund's current funding needs with the long-term preservation of its purchasing power and is consistent with the Minnesota Permanent School Fund's objectives. Our research also indicated that a 4.5% distribution rate based on a 3-year rolling average is consistent with the best practices amongst other educational endowments and similar institutions across the country. On page 11, you'll see that the task force also engaged in some analysis supported by SBI staff examining the potential effect of adopting such a policy on the Minnesota Permanent School Fund. So we looked at the historical returns of our fund, our fund's specific asset allocation model. We looked at historical revenues coming from Minnesota School Trust lands, and we used the SBI's forward-looking return assumptions to deliver or to generate several potential scenarios based on specific data to the Permanent School Fund. We looked at scenarios where returns were consistent with the SBI's long-term base case on capital markets behavior. We looked at scenarios where returns would be somewhat higher than that, a more robust market environment. We looked at scenarios where returns would be less robust than expected. We looked at highly volatile conditions. We looked at conditions where the future would look largely like the past and many others. I'm not presenting all of those to you on this slide, but you'll see we reached a few conclusions from that analysis. Most importantly, you'll see that in the scenarios where we adopt a 4.5% distribution rate calculated over a 3-year rolling average, you'll see on the bottom left of the page, we tried to model out what the value of the Permanent School Fund would look like under such a policy. And what we see is that in our central case, distributing 4.5% of the fund's value still allows the fund to grow modestly over time. And importantly, even in a downside scenario where market returns are not as rosy as our base case expectation, the fund's value is not diminished over time. And at the same time, you can see on the right side of the page that distributions from the fund by adopting such a policy would increase fairly significantly from where they've been over the last couple of years. The 2024 and 2025 bars represent actual reality. Those are what were actually distributed from the fund. And in years 2026 going forward, those are expectations about what the fund would distribute by adopting a new policy. And what you'll see is that the distribution amounts increase substantially in our base case. And again, even in a negative case or a relatively pessimistic case, distributions would increase substantially from where they are today. Moving forward to page 12, a few observations that the task force wanted to be sure were communicated. First is that selecting a distribution rate inherently represents a trade-off between current payouts and long-term growth of the fund. The task force believes that a distribution rate of 4.5% achieves an effective balance between those two objectives and can be expected to increase near-term distributions while also achieving long-term growth of the fund. We'd observe that the fund value can decline. That is the case today under the current framework, but under the new framework would also be possible for fund value to decline. That would happen when the distribution rate would exceed the combined value of investment returns and revenues from land management. We believe that using a three-year rolling average to calculate the distributable amount has the effect of striking a balance between reducing the year-to-year volatility of distributions to districts while also being sufficiently responsive to prolonged market downturns. Finally, we observe that the 4.5% distribution rate and a three-year rolling average period align with industry best practices. We believe achieve an effective balance between providing stable distributions to districts while preserving the purchasing power of the fund for future generations. To conclude on page 13, the task force would like to observe that the fund has grown significantly due to a combination of investment returns and land management revenues, but that outdated constitutional and statutory restrictions have impaired the fund's ability to achieve its objective of balancing the needs of current and future beneficiaries. Our recommendation is to adopt a modern market value-based distribution model that would better align the fund with best practices used by peer states and other similar institutions. We believe that a 4.5% distribution rate based on a three-year rolling average can provide stable and current funding to current beneficiaries while preserving the long-term purchasing power of the fund for the benefit of future generations. The nine members of this permanent school fund task force, after over a year's worth of research and analysis, unanimously endorsed the recommendations found in your report. I'll pause there and take any questions that you may have.
Thank you, Mr. Crack. Representative Igo, is there anyone else you want to testify?
The folks at SBI did a wonderful job for us, and you can see that's why they're great at their jobs, because that was fantastic.
Thank you. Yes, thank you, Mr. Crack, to you and to everyone on the task force for your careful work on this and your work on modernizing this constitutional provision. Is there any member discussion? Representative Long.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Igo, and thank you to the task force members for all of the diligence that you put into coming forward with your recommendation. I strongly support this proposal, and I'm glad it's before us today. I did want to ask one question, which is I note that the constitutional language still allows discretion for the legislature to set the distributable amount. So it's 4.5% as proposed for the statutory language here, but that would be language that the legislature could revisit under this proposal. Is that correct?
Representative Igo?
Mr. Chair, Representative Long, yep, that is correct. So that distributable amount will be in the statute that would be activated upon passage by the voters.
Thank you. Further?
Yes, please. Thank you. I appreciate that. And I know we had some back and forth on what the appropriate amount should be, and certainly understand the thought that went into 4.5%. I personally think we could probably do a little higher and still achieve the goals that you all have laid out of making sure that the fund is growing over time and even in downturns, but understand the rationale behind 4.5%. But I do hope that we can consider to have that conversation, particularly if we're seeing, 10%, 9% returns as we have over the last few years. Even if you're taking pretty generous inflation assumptions, you're going to be able to get above 4.5% and have a pretty good return still for the fund. So I just would love to continue that conversation if we're able to succeed in passing the amendment. And I did want to thank Representative Igo for working with us on the constitutional ballot language. And I know that we share the goal. In 2023, we passed an allocation for tribal schools, which don't get direct allocations under the school trust proposal. We funded the amount that they would otherwise be getting in 2023. And I know that's a goal that we share to make sure that schools are made whole for the tribal schools are made whole for the amount that would be increased here in this proposal, and would love to continue that conversation as we move towards the floor.
Thank you. Representative Long, so your oral amendment is on 2.29. I'm just kidding. No oral amendment?
No oral amendment.
All right. Thank you, Representative
Long. Mr. Chair, if I could just respond to that briefly, too.
Representative Igo.
And thank you to you, Representative Long, as well, for the collaboration we've had on this, helping with the ballot language, but also working on the tribal schools issue. I think we're really close to finding that solution that we're working on together to make sure we take care of all the kids in the state of Minnesota. So thank you for your support as well.
Thank you, Representative Igo. Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Igo, I'm just going to ask you to repeat something from your opening statement, and I didn't get a chance to write it down, but I think you gave like an example of the difference in amount per pupil, you know, historically over the last few years or whatever, what it would have been if at 4.5. Thank you.
Representative Igo.
Mr. Chair, Representative Scott, so right now the last distribution that went out was $68 per pupil in the state of Minnesota. Upon passage of this constitutional amendment by the voters, we would see that increase to over $95 per pupil.
Thank you, Representatives. Thank you, Representative Igo. Representative Nash.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Igo, thanks for the hard work and the creativity. I think you're about to see all yes votes, and I think that's just a fantastic thing to do on behalf of the students of the state of Minnesota. I know you put a lot of work in on this because we've talked about it on a number of occasions, but wanted to thank you for the hard work and the creativity on behalf of Minnesota students.
Representative Igo, for closing comments.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. This is, again, one of those bills that's going to do a lot of good. And, you know, when we heard the presentation from SBI, we're talking about beneficiaries, which is the official term. But beneficiaries, in this case, are kids. And that's what I really wanted to leave everyone with, that our forefathers who set up our Constitution and founded our state took the right action to set aside lands that were going to help fund public education. And now we get to sit here as a legislature in the year 2026, work together in a collaborative way with stakeholders across this state and with our legislative partners to come up with a bill that's going to unlock future potential for every single kid in the state of Minnesota. And we're going to do it without costing taxpayers a nickel. And I think it's a very rare opportunity that we find ourselves in, and we need to thank those that came before us for putting us in this position. But the sky is the limit, and now here we are. In this year, we're going to take those first steps to really starting to fund public education with how our forefathers found the state intended to do it, and we can do it in a really great way. So I appreciate the committee's time, the committee's consideration, and I hope we can continue to move this bill forward and get it to the voters in November.
Thank you, Representative Igo. I renew my motion that House File 3900 be re-referred to be placed on the general register. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, nay. The motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Igo. The next item on our agenda is House File 1849, also in this committee because it proposes a constitutional amendment. Representative Gordon, welcome to the Rules Committee. I will move House File 1849 before the committee, and we don't anticipate taking committee action on this, but wanted to hear presentation and have a member discussion on this bill. So Representative Gordon, welcome to the committee. Please present House File 1849.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. Shall the Minnesota Constitution be amended to place a limit of 2 terms on the offices of governor and lieutenant governor beginning with candidates elected in 2026? HF 1849 proposes this constitutional amendment ballot question. Governor Walz, Pawlenty, Ventura, and others could still serve 2 more terms. There are several arguments in favor of this that include 37 states have some type of term limits on their governors. People on both sides of the aisle like term limits. The time has never been better, given that we don't have an incumbent on the ballot and we don't know when we will have an open seat in the future. We are only talking about bringing the question to the voters, not making the decision for them. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Representative Gordon. Did you have any testifiers here? We don't have anyone signed up to testify. Was there someone who wanted to testify on this?
You just get me today.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Representative Gordon. Member discussion on House File 1849. Representative Coulter.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Gordon, for once again proving how succinctly you can present a bill. I just wanted to clarify, I know you're not a constitutional lawyer and neither am I, but your intent is that the idea here was that this language would prohibit anybody under any circumstances from being elected governor or lieutenant governor more than twice, correct?
Well, it's almost correct. I'm sorry, Mr.
Thank you,
Chair.
Thank you, Representative Coulter. Representative Gordon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Almost correct, with the exception of people that have previously been elected as governors. So because they could potentially serve, you know, like say Pawlenty or Walls potentially serve up to four terms given this language. So it doesn't start counting until the election of 2026.
Gotcha. Okay. Thank you. No, I thank you for that. That is an important. I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. That is an important clarification. And the reason I asked is that this language mirrors pretty well the language in the 22nd Amendment to the U.S. Constitution. And I know some folks running around Washington have questioned how tight and how locked that language is. So I just want to make sure we're all on the same page. Thanks.
Thank you, Representative Coulter. I think the language you're looking for is 2.5 and 2.6, that elections prior to the 2026 election are not to be counted. Representative Hollins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you for bringing this bill forward, like interested in the concept. I guess my question is, how did you settle on the two terms versus three or four? And how does that compare nationally to other states that might have term limits?
Representative Gordon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Two terms, I mean, basically just because it's the precedent set, you know, at the national level, and I think that's, I don't know the exact numbers. I've looked at it, but I don't remember them off the top of my head, of course, on the term limits in other states. There's some variation. I mean, I think the majority of them are two terms. You do have two states that have two-year terms and no term limits. I think that was New Hampshire and one other one, Vermont, maybe something like that. And then Virginia, I think, has 1 4-year term, and then you can't serve them consecutively, I want to say something. So it varies a little bit from state to state, but I think across the board, the two 4-year terms is fairly standard.
Thank you, Representative Gordon. Follow-up, Representative Hollins? Representative Gordon, I did have a follow-up on that. The lieutenant governor term limits seem different than federal term limits and maybe some other states, so I was curious what other states have term limits on the office of lieutenant governor?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That's a great question. I'm not 100% sure on that. I guess I haven't really looked into it. When we talked about, this is kind of one of the first bills that I worked on when I was a freshman here. Well, I'm still a freshman, but last year being my first year, and nonpartisan had kind of asked, well, what do you want to do? And I said, well, let's do governor and lieutenant governor and, you know, try that. So, I guess I don't know the answer to the question. If nonpartisan has anything they'd want to share on that, I'd be open to hearing from them. But.
Mr. Gehring, we'll put you on the spot a little bit here.
Mr. Chair, I've not specifically looked into these questions, but happy to take a look and get back to you.
Thank you. Is there any further member discussion? Seeing none, House File 1849 is laid over. Thank you, Representative Gordon.
Thank you, guys.
All right. The next order of business is the 2026 R13A resolution, which is a resolution that deals with a procedure for investigating impeachments involving state officers. The Rules Committee has in its possession two such resolutions, House Resolution 6 and House Resolution 7, providing respectively requesting respectively the impeachment of Governor Walz and Attorney General Ellison. This discussion arises from an understandable demand for public accountability for the multi-billion-dollar fraud scandal that Minnesotans have been embarrassed by. Minnesotans are rightfully demanding answers regarding the theft of billions of dollars of our state money in multiple overlapping fraud schemes. Minnesotans demand answers, and they are asking for accountability. When billions of dollars, hundreds of billions of dollars, or billions of dollars are siphoned away, it's understandable that the public demands answers and accountability. There are certainly remaining questions surrounding Governor Walz. He claimed that the state was forced to resume funding to Feeding Our Future due to a court order and due to the FBI. The presiding judge in the case took the extraordinary step of issuing a public rebuke, and Assistant Commissioner Darren Corte testified that the governor and the administration was not requested by the FBI to continue funding Feeding Our Future. There are serious similar serious questions surrounding Attorney General Ellison. Serious questions remain regarding a documented 54-minute meeting in December 2021 between Attorney General Ellison and individuals who were subsequently indicted in the Feeding Our Future scheme, as well as campaign contributions that resulted from individuals directly linked to the fraud scheme. I was present when Attorney General Ellison testified in front of Congress, making statements denying that he had received those campaign contributions. Those are simply examples of some of the serious questions that remain. As the House, the only step that we have to do direct accountability is the tool of impeachment. We do not have the power to arrest or prosecute for crimes, but Article 8 of the Minnesota Constitution gives the House the, quote, sole power of impeachment and states a legal standard for impeachment, quote, corrupt conduct in office or for crimes and misdemeanors. That said, this is an important legal process. It is not a process for partisan politics, and so it must be treated with the utmost seriousness. It's inherently designed to balance the need for accountability with due process. And as a result of these resolutions that are in the possession of the committee, we did some research about the historical precedent for impeachment in Minnesota, other states, as well as Congress. And the R13A resolution is before us as a result of that in that research to proceed with a structured investigation, both to establish a process for dealing with these impeachment resolutions as well as to set a precedent for the future, because Minnesota has not had such a precedent in the past. So first I will begin by asking Mr. Gehring to give us an overview on the history of impeachment both in Minnesota, other states, as well as Congress, the process of impeachment, and then walk us through the R13A resolution. Mr. Gehring.
Sure. So I'm happy to walk through all these topics just to sort of orient the committee to the content that is a part of the resolution. And I'll start with the general principles that come from the Constitution related to impeachment, because this is a topic that I think often you'll see if the resolutions move forward, you'll see some flavors of sort of ordinary lawmaking process in an impeachment. But actually, the roots of an impeachment action come from a separate article of the state Constitution. That's Article 8, as the chair referenced, that provides the authority to the legislature for impeachment or removal of certain officers. So the sort of top line principles from Article 8 of the Constitution provide for the House to have sole power of impeachment through a majority vote of all of its members, so that's 68 votes. And then if an impeachment resolution were to move forward from the House, it proceeds then to the Senate for a trial. So if you're using sort of a criminal law analogy for an impeachment process, I think of the House as being sort of the grand jury that decides on an indictment of an officer, and then the Senate acts as the actual jury that decides on conviction and ultimately removal of the officer from their position. The positions that are subject to impeachment under the Constitution include the governor, secretary of state, state auditor, attorney general, and judges, Supreme Court, Court of Appeals, and district court judges. And the standard, as the chair referenced, is for corrupt conduct in office or for crimes and misdemeanors. And that standard does not have a specific definition in the Constitution or in state law. That's within the discretion of the legislature, and particularly in the discretion of the House, to decide whether those standards have been met as part of its impeachment inquiry. One important item to note about the way impeachment works in Minnesota that's a little bit different than what you might have heard about federal impeachment is that once an officer is impeached by the House, that officer is prohibited from exercising the duties of their office until the Senate has taken action to acquit the officer. So effectively, an impeached officer is suspended from their position while the impeachment proceedings continue in Minnesota. And that is different than in some other examples. Impeachment is one example of in the Constitution of a removal power. The other removal power that, that members may have heard about or are aware of is the recall process, and the recall process is the process for voters to vote to remove someone from an office, including executive officers, but the impeachment power is entirely a legislative power using the legislature's investigation and removal powers independently on its own. There have been some examples of impeachments in Minnesota history. The most recent examples of an active impeachment inquiry are all from the 19th century. So in 1895, there's a judge that was impeached, and I'll just quote from the resolution that was adopted at that time, for arbitrary and tyrannical exercise of the duties of office and disregard for the Constitution and state laws, that resulted in an impeachment inquiry by the House in that year, which ultimately did not proceed to the Senate. The House did not, the full body of the House did not vote to move the impeachment to the Senate, so there was just a committee inquiry in that year. In 1882, there was a judge who was impeached and was ultimately found guilty and removed from office. The basic allegations there were that the judge was engaged in his duties while being drunk on the bench, effectively. In 1878, a judge was impeached for, again, quoting from the resolution, overbearing and offensive conduct. The Senate acquitted the judge at that time. And then in 1873, there's an example of an impeachment where the state treasurer was impeached. He actually resigned his position, but the Senate proceeded with the impeachment trial anyway and convicted him, and he ultimately was removed from office, and as part of his conviction was prohibited from seeking that office again in the future. There have been, in more recent times, other examples of impeached state officers, not in Minnesota, but in other states. In 2023, the Texas Attorney General was impeached. He was impeached by the House and ultimately acquitted by the Senate in that state. And then in 2021, there was also an impeachment in South Dakota. The Attorney General there also was impeached. He was impeached by the House and then was ultimately convicted by the Senate in that state for statements he made related to a law enforcement investigation of a car accident that had happened around that time. And members, there are other examples of impeachments both at the federal level and other states that I'm happy to take questions about if members have them.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, so that's kind of the base of what you're working from. I'm happy to walk through the resolution if you'd like to.
Thank you, Mr. Gehring. Yes, please walk through the R13A
resolution. So just quickly, the R13A resolution, as the chair references, setting up a structure for an investigation within the House. The resolution is fairly straightforward, but this sort of high-level principles requires that resolutions be referred to the House Committee on Fraud Prevention and State Agency Oversight Policy for investigation. And then this resolution, through item 2, provides some minimum standards for how the committee is required to conduct its investigation, including, starting on line 17, requirement that the committee hear witness testimony related to the allegations of impeachable conduct. Item B, starting on line 19, requires the committee to collect and review evidence, including through use of the legislative subpoena power if necessary. And item C, starting on line 23, authorizes the committee to exercise other sort of inherent powers of committee, some of which are found in Mason's related to committee investigations, to ensure that their investigation is based in actual law and fact. And then on page 2, item D allows the committee to adopt other procedures to actually conduct the process in a fair and efficient manner. Item 3 on line 3 of page 2 provides for participation by the ranking minority members of the Committee on Fraud Prevention. That includes allowing the minority members to offer evidence and to call witnesses selected by them to receive testimony during at least one day of the investigation. Item 4, starting on line 8, allows subjects of an impeachment inquiry to be represented by legal counsel and also guarantees rights under the Constitution, both the federal and state constitutions and other applicable law. And item 5 and 6 are combined together for the final report of that committee. The committee is required to issue its final report that would include detailed findings from its investigation and other information and materials it may deem appropriate, and that it must do so by May 1st of 2026. And Mr. Chair, that is the resolution.
Thank you, Mr. Gehring. Next, we will proceed to testimony again, we are taking testimony on the R13A resolution. It obviously refers to resolutions proposing impeachment of a state officer, two of those, which are House Resolution 7 and House Resolution 8. So I would ask the testifiers keep their comments to the process for investigation and reasons providing the legal grounds to proceed with an investigation, beginning with Representative Weiner and Representative Davis as the chief authors of House Resolution 7 and House Resolution 8.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Schultz.
Just for quick clarity, it's House Resolution 6 and House Resolution 7. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Weiner.
Sorry, Mr. Chair, I'm experiencing a little bit of technical difficulties. Bear with me. Okay. Thank you for the opportunity, Chair, members of the community committee. Thanks for the opportunity to present House Resolution 6, calling for the impeachment of Governor Tim Walz for failure to faithfully execute the laws of the state of Minnesota, abuse of power, and obstruction of oversight. Under Minnesota Constitution Article 8, Section 1, the governor may be impeached for malfeasance, nonfeasance, or corrupt conduct. These standards do not require a criminal conviction. They require a breach of public trust and a failure to uphold the duties of the office. Additionally, Article 5, Section 3, requires the government to ensure that the laws are faithfully executed. Minnesota statutes governing fraud, oversight, and fiduciary responsibilities require state leadership to safeguard taxpayer funds. Evidence presented in legislative and congressional investigation show that billions in taxpayer funds were lost through fraud in Minnesota social services programs. Oversight systems failed repeatedly under executive leadership. Federal investigation and lawmakers have estimated up to $9 billion in fraud across multiple programs administered by the state. This represents not a minor administrative lapse, but a systematic breakdown in governance. Central to H.R. 6 is sworn testimony and documented statements from whistleblowers along with years of OLA reports. According to testimony presented before congressional committees, state employees repeatedly raised concerns about the fraud. Those warnings were ignored or suppressed. Whistleblowers repeatedly were retaliated against after coming forward. State legislative testimony further stated, Walz's administration turned a blind eye in the face of countless whistleblower reports. Additional accounts point to employees who attempted to stop the fraud were marginalized or threatened. Oversight mechanisms were weakened instead of strengthened, and these actions meet the definition of abuse of power and obstruction. Nonfeasance in office is the failure to act despite repeated warnings of fraud. I'm sorry, nonfeasance in office. Malfeasance in office is allowing continued disbursement of funds after fraud indicators were identified. Abuse of power. Retaliation against the whistleblowers raising lawful concerns and suppression of internal reporting mechanisms. And the failure to faithfully execute the law, which is a breakdown in enforcement of anti-fraud safeguards in a violation of public trust and fiduciary duty. This was not a single incident. It was a pattern. Early warnings date back years. Continued fraud during multiple budget cycles. Escalation, despite public exposure and investigations. In one of the largest cases, the Feeding Our Future fraud scheme alone involved hundreds of millions of dollars in misuse of funds. Impeachment is not about public disagreement. It's about breach of duty, failure of leadership, loss of public trust. And when the governor knows of widespread fraud, fails to act, and allows retaliation against those who speak out, that meets the constitutional threshold for impeachment. H.R. 6 is about restoring accountability. The question before this committee is simple. Did the governor fulfill his duty to protect taxpayers' dollars? Did he uphold the law? Did he respond appropriately to credible warnings? Based on the evidence, whistleblower testimony, and documented failures, the answer is no. For this reason, I respectfully urge the Rules Committee to advance H.R. 6. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Weiner. Representative Davis to H.R. 7.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, for letting me testify on House Resolution 7. Providing for the impeachment of Keith Ellison. Members, under Article 8, Section 2 of the Minnesota Constitution, the Attorney General may be impeached for for corrupt conduct in office. A clear violation of his constitutional oath, including the failure to faithfully execute the laws or any dishonest conduct, is more than enough grounds for this House to act upon the following allegations. The people of Minnesota deserve to know why their Attorney General sat down with individuals tied directly to the Feeding Our Future fraud network, offered to shield them from investigators, and then took their money. On December 11th, 2021, while the FBI had already been investigating Feeding Our Future for 8 full months, Attorney General Keith Ellison met with a group directly tied to the fraud network at an off-site location. On the secret audio recording of that meeting, Ikram Mohammed, who later pleaded guilty to wire fraud, specifically talked about Safari Restaurant, Afro Deli, and the Feeding Our Future network. She described key elements of how the fraud network operated and complained about state agency scrutiny. I urge everyone to listen to that recording in its entirety. Instead of supporting the state agencies trying to stop the fraud, Mr. Ellison told them he was very concerned and said the matter has my attention, and that just an inquiry from the AG's office is enough to make them knock it off. He offered to help push back against the very agencies he is sworn to defend. The individuals even gave him the personal name of the official to target at MDE in order to help cover up their activities. 9 days later, on December 20th, 2021, $10,000 in campaign donations flowed into his campaign and family PACs from people tied directly to that meeting, including the brother of Ikram Mohammed, Gandhi Youssef Mohammed, who just last week pleaded guilty to money laundering. This meeting was not constituent service. It has the clear appearance of corrupt conduct in office. The state's top law enforcement officer sided with people tied to an active fraud probe against the agencies his office represents. Minnesotans lost hundreds of millions of dollars meant for children's meals, while the Attorney General accepted donations from that same network that stole the money. In February 2026, when confronted under oath by U.S. Senator Josh Hawley, Attorney General Keith Ellison looked him in the eye and he denied taking their money. That statement was false. Ellison denied taking campaign contributions from the fraud network 9 separate times during that exchange. It appears he lied under oath before Congress, which is a violation of 18 U.S.C. 1621. Again, the people's lawyer met with suspects in his official capacity as Attorney General, they pledged to give money to his campaign. He then offered to run interference against state agencies investigating the fraudsters, even going as far as texting his staff during the meeting to look into this. And then days later, he received maxed out donations from the network. When directly asked by a U.S. senator this last February, the Attorney General denied taking their money, yet the records show otherwise. And members, I've included in your packets a spreadsheet from his campaign finance report showing the donations received, along with an article showing he returned the money nearly 4 years later after intense public scrutiny. I urge the committee to move forward with this motion, Mr. Chair. Members, we have a historic amount of fraud taking place in our state. Historic actions are warranted. Minnesota deserves accountability and transparency with its constitutional officers. To those who would argue that the Attorney General knew nothing of the fraud, Chairman James Comer's House Oversight Committee heard testimony from multiple whistleblowers, including current state employees. Many of these individuals, some of them Democrats, testified under oath that Governor Walz and Attorney General Keith Ellison knew about the Feeding Our Future fraud as early as 2019 and 2020, yet deliberately turned a blind eye while $300 million of taxpayers' money vanished. They also reported being retaliated against. These brave individuals deserve our gratitude, not condemnation. As a former investigator in the Medicaid Fraud Division within the Attorney General's office, Kasa Magan wrote that top Democrats suffered from a feckless fear of being called racist or Islamophobic. He stated that Walz and Ellison's image has been tarnished because politicians looked the other way, while fraudsters exploited both the Somali community and the state's political cowardice. Now, that's coming from someone who worked in the Attorney General's office. Feeding Our Future defense attorney Ryan Pasiga told the New York Times no one was doing anything about the red flags. It was like someone was stealing money from the cookie jar and they kept refilling it. I have included pertinent articles and documents to back up all of these claims. As you do your due diligence to investigate these findings, you will clearly see that this was not incompetence. It was a choice, a political choice, that cost Minnesota taxpayers billions of dollars. Members, we have the opportunity to do what is right and hold our constitutional officers accountable. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Davis. I have four other folks who signed up to testify before the noon deadline yesterday to sign up to testify.
Mr. Chair, I do have questions for Representative Weiner and Representative Davis.
If Representative Davis and Representative Weiner would sit close by so you're ready for member discussion, we'll do it, handle it then, if that's all
thank
right.
Thank you.
Representative Howard, thank you. First on my list, I have Faye Bernstein and Alan Lizdahl, followed by Jody McCarthy and Nathaniel Olson. So, so we have time for a member discussion. I'd ask that you keep your testimony to the two-minute time limit that was posted, as well as keep your testimony related to the resolution and the reasons for proceeding with an investigation. Ms. Bernstein, go ahead and state your name for the record and
my name is Faye Bernstein. Chair Niska, members, thank you for allowing me to speak today. I'm one of those whistleblowers, and I am a current state employee. And I'm also a Democrat. I've only voted Democrat. And that's why I think this is a really sad day for me. I consider myself a very loyal person. I have worked at the state agency I'm at for 20 years. I believe I've had three jobs since I graduated from college. I've lived on the same block for 20 years. I'm kind of a ride or die person. But I want you to know my experience. And what happened to me was, 7 years ago, I was what I would consider at the top of my game. I was in one of those rare times in life where you really enjoy going to work and you know that you are doing a very good job and life was really, really good. And everything I'm going to say now, I don't in any way mean to reference my coworkers, my peers. Your average state employee is very, very good, very good. I'm not unique in any way. I'm not uniquely smarter than anyone else or uniquely able to notice fraud any more than anyone else. I'm just a regular state employee. All of my comments and my concerns are really about the leadership and those that have appointed that leadership. So about 7 years ago, I noticed risky contracts that I was seeing. I had a promotion and I, for the first time, was seeing many contracts, more than just my own. Everything was sort of funneling through me and my work area. And so I started going up the ladder for the next 6 months, as the person would do, and talking to my supervisor, then their supervisor, and up and up. And so what I found was that I was really kind of getting nowhere. So after that first thing of noticing these things and realizing I was getting nowhere, I then realized that we had incredibly unqualified leadership. Not only did people not really know the solution to what I was bringing, but they really didn't even understand what I was saying. And that didn't make a lot of sense to me, because looking at their salary and their job title, this is something they should have clearly understood and said thank you and proceeded to solve it. And that isn't what happened at all. What actually happened is the messenger gets shot. I became a very unpopular person amongst leadership there. And the retaliation in the smear campaign is strong. I was called everything from incompetent to a favorite is racist. You people who speak about fraud at state agencies, the first thing that leadership goes to is racism. And that is very hard to take. It is humiliating. It is career killing, obviously. Who is going to hire someone who is considered racist? So at some point in that period of time, in 2019, there was a poster put up at the agency, and it had three names on it. It was one of those posters that was sort of that if you see something, say something kind of thing. And there was three names on the poster that we were to contact if we had concerns about fraud, waste, or abuse. And so I was working with those three people. And over the next year, those three people really made my life about as miserable as it could be. That was a period where my son was young. He's a teenager now. He's with me. But he was young at that time, and I used to sit on the front step of my house and cry because I didn't want him to see me cry. Because you don't want a young kid to see that. And those three names. Okay, let me just talk about those three names. One is our ethics officer in the agency I work at. She called me to tell me that if I spoke in front of the legislative committee, that I would likely be fired. So that's our ethics officer. Then our, at that time, chief compliance officer, now our commissioner, she had me involuntarily transferred to a different position to get me out of where I was. She called me on a Saturday along with our HR representative and told me that when I returned to work the next week that I had a new job. And I said, do I have any choice? And the answer was no, it's this or nothing. And the third person on that list, who was our director of auditing, so he's an auditor, he completely outed me. I reported fraud to him, and what he did is call up the person I was reporting on and said, Faye Bernstein just told me da-da-da-da about you, just completely outed me, which, as you can imagine, led to more of me crying on my front step.
I'm sorry, Ms. Bernstein, this happened to you, and thank you for sharing your story. I hope we pass this resolution so you can provide further information, you and other whistleblowers. So, thank you.
And I'm sorry, I've testified a few times and I've never cried, but I guess I've never thought about myself sitting on that front step. And that just really kind of got me.
If you could wrap up your testimony.
Thank you. So this did not end. It continues. I speak to individuals from other agencies. As recent as last Monday, 3 days ago, I spoke to individuals from another agency, and this is precisely what is going on. The retaliation continues, the fraud continues, and there is no accountability. There is absolutely no accountability. And what that makes me repeatedly think of is the cartoon with the dead horse on the table, and everyone is walking around thinking, should we get a new saddle? Should we give the horse a new name? Should we train the rider better? And of course, that's not going to solve it. I don't have any sage wisdom. I'm, like I said, an average state employee. But I grew up on a farm, and I know a dead horse when I see it.
Thank you, Ms. Bernstein. Next on the list, I have Alan Lisdahl. You could come forward and state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Chair Nischka and committee members, I am Alan Lisdahl. I don't come here with a law degree or a bunch of years of experience as a politician. I am but a voice crying in the wilderness. I was born and raised in a small town just north of here. It was a time and place where I experienced the true Minnesota, where doing the right thing was expected and being responsible and kind to your neighbor was just the way it was. Oh, and we were, don't you know, we were proud to be from Minnesota. Skol Vikings and the Purple People Eaters, don't you know. Now, when I travel out of state and people find out I'm from Minnesota, they say, oh, where all the fraud, corruption, and chaos is happening? Things appear to have gone terribly wrong under your watch, Governor Walz. As the top elected official, how could you have turned an apparent blind eye to unprecedented corruption and fraud? You have sown discord, distrust, and dishonor instead of order, integrity, and tranquility. You have embarrassed our state. Is this what you returned to Minnesota to do after your time in Washington? Having served over 20 years in the military myself, I understand what it means to swear an oath. As a top-level military and elected official, you have taken an oath, and that becomes a sacred duty. That duty spells selfless service. Or did you somehow forget that? Billions have been stolen from the people and distributed to those pursuing unjust activities. We have patiently suffered in the hope that you would govern with truth and wisdom. We trusted you. You betrayed us. You let us down. If the lawlessness continues, you, Governor Walz, will be sentencing Minnesota to 1,000 years of darkness. Again, is that your intent? A line has been crossed beyond the consent of the governed. You have brought dishonor and shame to my beloved Minnesota.
Thank you, Mr. Lisdahl.
I drove for 2.5 hours away to testify.
Please conclude.
Few brief moments because Minnesota is that important to me. The immediate solution to this fraud and corruption is that our legislators and the judiciary move swiftly and justly. Whoever has ears, let them hear. This day, Governor Walz, you are being delivered into the hands of justice, and you and anyone that comes after you that defies what we, the good people of Minnesota, consent to will be brought down.
Thank you. Next, I have Jody McCarthy. Go ahead and introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Okay, thank you. My name is Jody McCarthy, and I appreciate everything that's been said here. I appreciate it a lot. I've been working on writing a recall so we can look at, because there's two ways of having somebody removed, by impeachment, which would give the legislature power. The people would actually look at them as somebody who came in, cared enough, and did what needed to be done to support the whistleblowers, to support the people. And so I've been waiting for this to happen so they didn't have to do a recall. Now, working in the process of a recall, they're both the same thing. You're under the same directive. Yeah. I would focus on the non-fiescence because it's really easy to prove from beginning to end, and you don't have to prove everything that was talked about here today. But I encourage everyone to actually really consider how important it is to have an impeachment versus a recall. A recall requires 25 people to sign a piece of paper to go through the Secretary of State and then go on to the Supreme Court. If it looks like you have reasonable cause, you can do a recall. Now you need 25% of the votes, signature number, which would, there's of the last general election, which in Minnesota was what, roughly 3.2 million? So you'd have to have nearly a million votes or signatures. I can get a million signatures. I grew up in Minnesota. My family's been here since before it was a state. The first teacher in Dakota County was my great-great uncle. Okay? We can get that many signatures, but do you have any idea what getting that many signatures roiled up against our state government could do? I hate to think that it might actually make the ICE raids look like a picnic. We need to understand that we, Minnesota citizens feel like tax slaves. All of those dollars are going to a culture.
Ms. McCarthy, thank you for coming and testifying. Appreciate it. Next, I have Nathaniel Olson. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Good morning. Thank you, Chairman. I'm Nathaniel Olson. I'm the disability advocate for the state of Minnesota, and I'm here to testify for Governor Walz's impeachment. As a disability advocate for the state of Minnesota, I have seen nothing more than fraud happening over our state. I sat in an ICS home getting ready to go on vacation and understanding that I was under a guardianship that said that they would care for me. When they completely lied to me, I knew very well that these people do not care. I urge people to vote yes to impeach Governor Walz because here is why. Taxpayer dollars are being thrown overseas to fund a terrorist group. If you look at the United States Constitution, that is in Article 3, that is treason. Governor Walz doesn't care about the Minnesota people, nor does he care about girls being protected, nor does he care about the disability people that are being suffering and abused and being homeless. As a disability advocate, I cannot stand here and watch these people suffer. I cannot stand here and see Governor Walz have a press conference and blame the President of the United States for everything. We need to hold Governor Walz accountable. It is time for us to say enough is enough. Governor Walz needs to go and suffer the consequences because I cannot sit here and watch these people suffer. So I urge everyone to vote yes to get rid of this governor. Keith Ellison has no place to serve as the Attorney General, because he does not care about the Minnesota people either. It's quite interesting that we can have 100,000 people show up for the Nose Kings protests, but I'm wondering where are the protests for the disability people? I'm wondering where are the protests for the families that have lost their kids in the state of Minnesota? Governor Walz can sit back and watch the people suffer because it's good for him. Thank goodness he was not Vice President of the United States, because he cannot run the state of Minnesota. And why would we think he could run the United States if he cannot keep his own citizens safe? And Amy Klobuchar, she'll be Governor Walz 2.0, because she will
thank
continue
you, Mr.
the fraud.
Olson,
thank you, Mr. Representative.
So that's the public testifiers that signed up in accordance with our notice. So we'll move next to member discussion. First, Representative Howard.
I can defer to Leader Long first. Okay, I guess I do have questions for either Representative Weiner or Representative Davis. Thank you. Just hoping to understand a little bit the trajectory of where we're headed with this. And ahead of this hearing, the House Freedom Caucus put out a statement. They said the Minnesota House Freedom Caucus just dropped a bombshell that every conservative in the state has been waiting for. In a powerful video statement filmed inside the state capitol, the group confirmed the impeachment hearings are moving forward against Tim Walz and Attorney General Ellison. So I guess my first question to you both, is that true? Are these proceedings moving forward?
Thank you, Representative Howard, for the question. I am hopeful that we could move. Oh, Mr. Chair, I apologize.
Thank you, Representative Howard. Is there one of them that you're directing that question to?
Either would be fine.
Representative Davis, go ahead.
Mr. Chair, thank you, and my apologies. Representative Howard, it is my hope that House Resolution 7 and House Resolution 6 would find a pathway to move forward, because again, we've had a historic amount of fraud in our state, and I know this would be a historic moment for Minnesota with impeachment proceedings, but I think it's warranted. So that is my hope.
Representative Weiner, did you have something to add there?
I would say we are here right now, aren't we? This is moving forward. This is the start of the process. So of course, this is good. And to bait and switch with the House Freedom Caucus, that has nothing to do with this. That's a statement. The real issue at hand here is $9 billion worth of fraud. And if you're going to distract from the intent and the purpose of why we're here today, then shame on you. Let's talk about the issue. That is the fraud in this state. That's accountability of the governor.
Representative Howard, follow-up.
Yeah. To Representative Weiner or Representative Davis, as your chair mentioned, your resolutions are not before this Rules Committee, and you announced that they were moving forward. So that was my question. You mentioned, Representative Davis, that you hope they're moving forward. Do you have the support of your Republican caucus to move forward with these proposals? Everybody? Or Representative Davis or Representative Weiner?
Representative Davis or Weiner?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As I'm sure you know, we've had 21 signers onto the resolution.
Representative Howard, follow-up?
Follow-up, just another piece. I was listening to your testimony closely. You mentioned a few of the concepts that merit impeachment proceedings. You mentioned breach of duty, upholding the law, dishonesty, loss of trust, impropriety of campaign contributions. I would assume, I guess maybe I shouldn't assume, a question. Do you think that those principles and those resolutions should apply, whether you're bringing forward impeachment resolutions on a Democrat or a Republican, or do you think they should only apply if you're bringing forward impeachment proceedings against a Democrat?
Representative Howard, is there a particular member you're asking that testify?
They both testified, so either Representative Weiner or Representative Davis.
Representative Davis.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for the question. Yes, see, for state constitutional officers anyway, we have the sole authority in the Minnesota House to impeach and to move forward with impeachment proceedings. It's right in our Constitution. So I don't care if you have an R or a D by your name.
Another.
Representative Weiner, did you want to answer that question?
State the question again, please.
Representative Howard.
The question is, do you think these should these principles that you laid out should apply whether charges are brought against a Democrat or Republican, or should they apply only if they're you're bringing forward a charge against a Democrat?
Well, Representative Weiner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Accountability should apply whether you're a D or an R behind your name. There should be 67 Republicans and 67 Democrats in favor of this impeachment, because there should be accountability. We are accountable to the taxpayers in this state. And when $9 billion worth of fraud takes place, I would expect a moral outrage whether you have a D or R behind your name. So therefore, yes, we should have more support on this from both sides of the aisle, because I do believe out in the public, they're upset. They're angry when every dollar that we spend here is coming out of somebody's pocket, and they are struggling to get by. And we've heard this again and again, bills that come to the floor from both sides of the aisle, and we hear people are struggling. So to know that when they pay in their check, when they pay in their taxes, I'm sorry, and $9 billion are frauded, there should be a justifiable anger that should take place. And it is taking place across the state, and they want accountability. And that's why these articles of impeachment are here.
Representative Howard, follow up?
Yep, follow up. And the reason I ask that is because, you know, in your statement you said that you've dropped this bombshell that every conservative in the state has been waiting for, and it led me to believe this might just be partisan in nature. Also in that statement, you referenced Walz and Ellison pushed radical policies that left Minnesotans paying the price. The pushing of radical policies meriting impeachment, I think, raises questions about whether this is a partisan project or not. But I'll give you guys, both the Representative Wiener, Representative Davis, a couple more chances to help kind of assuage my concerns that this just might be political in nature. I'm curious about, you know, the resolution states that this would be for corrupt conduct in office or for crimes and misdemeanors. And so I'm trying to establish where that line is for folks. I'm curious, would you think allegations of sexual abuse are grounds for impeachment?
Representative Howard, are you asking that question to one of the particular testifiers?
Either Representative Davis or Representative Wiener.
Representative Davis.
Thank you.
Point of parliamentary inquiry, Mr. Chair.
State your point of parliamentary inquiry.
What does sexual misconduct have to do with House Resolution 6 or 7, which are the impeachment proceedings that impeachment resolutions that we are discussing today, and more specifically, the resolution to send these investigations to the Fraud Committee?
Mr. Chair, we are not discussing House Resolution 6 or 7. We're discussing House Resolution 13A. Can you stick to that, please?
I think the point of parliamentary inquiry is well taken as it relates to R13A. I don't see anything in it about sexual misconduct. Certainly, I would think that if there was a resolution proposing impeachment of a state officer for sexual misconduct, I expect Representative Davis and Representative Wiener would both think that that should be referred for further investigation.
I guess that's my question.
Representative Davis.
Mr. Chair, you're absolutely right. But to the point of conservatives wanting justice, accountability, and transparency in the state, absolutely, Representative Howard, but not just conservatives. You just heard from a whistleblower, a testifier who's a Democrat who wants to see the same thing in her state, Representative Howard. Thank you for the question.
Well, that's not what you said in your statement that you posted as the Freedom Caucus. But I would note that, of course,
Howard, I didn't recognize you. Oh, you have some further follow-up?
I do.
We do have a few other people on the list.
I'll try to be quick.
Wrap it up.
You know, I would note that, of course, President Trump has been accused by more than 20 women of sexual assault. I don't think there's any instances.
Mr. Chair, point of parliamentary inquiry. What does that
mean?
You don't have the floor, Representative Davis. I have the floor. I'm trying to establish if this isn't a partisan project. I would assume there's instances where you've all called for the impeachment of President Trump, who's been credibly accused of assault, who's been charged with 34 felony counts, been charged with racketeering for overturning the free, fair election. I'll just have just one or two more questions because I think they're really relevant since there's a lot of discussion about fraud. Would you think illegally firing more than a dozen inspector generals whose job is it to track fraud, would that be an impeachable offense for corrupt conduct in offices for crimes and misdemeanors?
Representative Howard, I don't think your statement is fine. I don't think further discussion about those questions is relevant, especially in light of the fact that President Trump has been impeached twice by the U.S. House of Representatives. So I don't think you're making the point that you think you're trying to make. Democrats have impeached President Trump over many of the allegations that you're talking about. That doesn't really go to the question whether the R13A resolution should be adopted by the Rules Committee. So thank you. Thank you, Representative Howard. Representative Schultz.
I won't ask another question, but just to wrap.
Briefly.
I'll just briefly wrap and say that I think everybody can see what's going on here. You know, amid serious times with families facing serious economic challenges, this is a fundamentally unserious proposal by a fundamentally unserious party who isn't interested in governing. Gas prices are rising because of Trump's illegal war in Iran. Healthcare, housing, child care costs are spiking. We have hospitals closing. Yet this is what we're going to do today? A bill that's absolutely going nowhere, dead on arrival, aimed at, you know, sticking an eye on the governor and the attorney general. We get it. We get it. You guys don't like the governor and the attorney general. You don't like that the governor led us through unprecedented economic times and then won election handily. You don't like that he's balanced the budget on time every year of his, and you don't like his policies that you call radical, like paid family leave and helping kids. And you don't like Attorney General Ellison for the ways he stood up to Trump. And at every turn, you're having complete silence on a president who basically has an impeachable offense on any day that ends in Y. And so it's tough to take this serious. And I think what Minnesotans want us to do with the last remaining bit of session is to focus on the issues they care about. Let's help make lives more affordable. Let's actually get stuff done instead of just catering to a narrow band of folks and the narrow band of legislators that seem to have walls derangement syndrome.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate the fact that we are sitting here today discussing one of the most significant moments in Minnesota's political history. Since 1858, our state has never been in the sort of crisis that we are today. Never before in our history. Never before in our history has a member of this legislature, let alone two of them, let alone the other members of this legislature who have signed on to these very resolutions, ever before brought impeachment resolutions versus any member, any constitutional officer in Minnesota, ever before. Not through any other scandal in state history has this happened. So what brought us here? What brought us here? Not following the law, not enforcing the law, which is the role of the executive branch. $9 billion of fraud in Medicaid only, over $300 million in Feeding Our Future, and it's all laid out in these impeachment resolutions. We in this body need to take our jobs seriously. Our role here today. And when I think about that, it is our responsibility in the House of Representatives with the sole power of impeachment. It is our responsibility, our constitutional responsibility, our fiduciary responsibility, our responsibility to protect Minnesotans. That is the issue that is before us right now. Not what's going on in D.C., but is what has happened in Minnesota. And the actions taken by our constitutional officers. That's what's before us. And I want to appreciate the motion that's before us, which is that these specific impeachment articles and resolutions are fully investigated, which is what the motion before the body is today, in case Representative Howard had forgotten. Today, we get to bring light to darkness. We get to allow truth to guide our path for accountability for Minnesotans. Minnesotans demand this of all political stripes. There's no Minnesotan who wants to experience under any administration the billions of dollars of fraud that we've seen. It is not acceptable to Minnesotans that whistleblowers have been penalized, stripped of their jobs, targeted personally, some who've had to move from this state because of the actions of this administration. The retaliation will continue unless we do something. This is about accountability. We today have an opportunity to help restore the voice of the people. We serve in the people's house. And every single day, Minnesotans in every corner of this state are held accountable for their actions. But the question before this body is, will this issue be fully investigated? Will we have that investigation done and delivered to us so that we, as the House of Representatives, can do our constitutional duty? That's what this is about. And so, to my friends across the aisle, if you don't want to join us in demanding accountability, let that be your legacy, that you will allow any administration of any political stripe to not enforce the laws that we pass. This is a conscious decision that we get to make today. Let's investigate. Let's vote yes.
Thank you, Representative Schultz. Representative Jordan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The resolution on impeachment investigations is dumb. And I don't understand what we're doing here. Have there been crimes, charges, and convictions for our executives? No. Do we impeach Minnesota's elected officials just because we don't like them? No. Have there been criminals and scammy businesses that have ripped off our government? Yes. And are there actual solutions to prevent that from happening in the future? Also, yes. We could be working on those instead of doing this and listening to people just air grievances against Keith Ellison and Tim Walz. We actually have a fraud committee that could be doing this, but they haven't heard any bills to actually crack down on fraud, so I don't know what they're doing either. And this is exactly the kind of political stunt that has taken over our politics and just blackpilled an entire generation of kids. You're obviously just doing this for social media clips, as social media clips have already been referenced. This is for campaign emails and fundraising. And this just makes me so mad as a millennial when I think about what my generation has just really experienced, which is just avoidable mass shooting after avoidable mass shooting. We see politicians doing garbage like this rather than doing anything about it. We had the opportunity to vote on gun bills that would prevent another generation from experiencing that same trauma that my generation has experienced. And there's not a single Republican that could stand up there and say we need to protect children from mass shootings in school. I also just think of the economic realities where so many young people right now have just lost hope that an average job can help them afford basic necessities. Even if you do everything right, you're being ripped off by huge insurance corporations that you all here in this body defend. It is actually impossible for millennials at this point. The average age of new home ownership in this country is 50 years old. We also know that home ownership is the easiest ticket to the middle class. Instead of focusing on solutions like we should be in this committee, we're instead focusing on this and airing petty grievances. We don't have a working health care. This is the most wealthy country in the world, and people are forgoing care that they need to live because it's too expensive, and we're instead just holding a political circus for Action for Liberty. It's embarrassing for this entire body. It's not serious, and we actually know that every member of your caucus doesn't agree with this. Only 28 people in your caucus have signed on to it in a caucus of, what, 67? That's not the majority of your party. It's great that we're talking about accountability. Like, that's a thing that we should be talking about is accountability, but instead we're doing performative outrage. And I don't care. Like, this doesn't matter. Like, the federal government is just killing Minnesotans in Minneapolis for no reason. They're violating their basic rights and killing them. And then lying to all Minnesotans and saying that Renee Good and Alex Preddy were domestic terrorists. That was a lie that our federal government did. Where is the accountability for that? No one seems to care that this was all covered up, evidence was stolen, and not being even shared with the BCA. This also, I mean, no one even seems to care about the Epstein files where Donald Trump is listed as going and being a friend of Jeffrey Epstein. And anyway, people are already interrupting to say we can't talk about the Epstein files. We can't talk about all of these things that we need to be talking about. Instead, we're engaging in this political circus. This is another just simple, stupid distraction because two of your members skipped an education committee to go drink and came back to the House floor inebriated with one of them carrying a gun. Which, by the way, as Mr. Gehring pointed out, the impeachment that actually happened in Minnesota was because a judge was intoxicated in his courtroom. So that was a real impeachable offense that happened, and it was conducted here in the House. But that's not what we're talking about here. This is an insane waste of time. I can't believe this is what the Republican caucus is choosing to spend their limited committee time on, and it is embarrassing. So, Mr. Chair, I hope we don't waste time in this committee again like this.
Thank you, Representative Jordan. Representative Coulter.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, counting my time as staff, excuse me, this is my 15th legislative session. And I want to thank Representative Schultz for bringing it back to the thing that we're actually talking about here, Resolution 13A, because I think some of your own members maybe don't know what we're talking about here. And this resolution is the most harebrained thing I think I have ever seen. Impeachment is a serious thing. It is basically a legal process to overturn the will of the voters. This resolution tasks the fraud committee, and it is a fraud committee, the only committee with a Republican majority, coincidentally chaired by a Republican candidate for governor, with investigation on that. Doing that is insulting to Minnesotans who think our votes should actually count for something. I would honestly feel more comfortable if we just picked a random committee out of a hat. Here you go. Good luck, Ag Committee. I actually would trust the Ag Committee. In 33 days, this legislature is done. We're going home. A lot of us will not ever come back as legislators. And this is really how we're spending our time? Minnesotans expect us to solve problems. This creates them. This resolution, and I want to be clear, I'm talking about the resolution, not the person whose fever dream I can only imagine this emerged from, is stupid. Next year, tens of thousands of Minnesotans will lose health care and more will go hungry. And this is what we're doing. Right now, it costs more to send a kid to childcare than it does to the University of Minnesota. It also costs too much to send them to the University of Minnesota. And this is what we're doing. Minnesotans, including DFLers, want an OIG bill that works, that can go after the fraud. And this is what we're doing? Folks are sick of us fighting all the time. Folks are sick of the partisan pot shots. And I'm not naive enough to think that any of that's going away anytime soon. But more than that, more than any of that, what folks are sick of, with all the serious things that they have going on in their lives, is politicians who treat the decisions that we make in this place that matter in their lives like a game. And when Republicans vote to end the session 9 weeks early, when your members ditch committee to go day drinking, and when you pull stunts like this, I don't blame them.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, I want everyone in this room and everyone in the public to imagine for a moment, if you will, that $9 billion worth of fraud would have happened under Governor Tim Pawlenty. I would say that probably he would have been forced to resign by now. I'm just speculating, but based on my history in this place, there's always a double standard. And Representative Jordan, you're talking about petty grievances. $9 billion in fraud is a petty grievance. Taxpayers, today is tax day, the day that the government extracts money from you that involuntarily, okay? A petty grievance of $9 billion, and we talk about affordability, $9 billion would go a long way towards helping affordability in the state of Minnesota for people that can't even afford to put gas in their car right now. And to call this idea harebrained, Representative Coulter, $9 billion, holding people accountable for $9 billion in fraud, I don't see as harebrained, and I don't think the people of Minnesota do either. You talk about Representative Howard of every day ending in Y. Every day ending in Y is a new fraud story in the state of Minnesota. It's embarrassing, and it's expensive, and it ticks most people off. It ticks me off a lot as a taxpayer who just paid thousands of dollars in taxes. The people of this state want accountability. That's why we're here today. It's not because of what President Trump did. It's not because of what something J.D. Vance said. It's not any of that. This is what is within our power as state legislators to bring before the legislature and this committee to hold elected officials accountable. The governor needs to be held accountable for this fraud. The attorney general lied before Congress. That's no small thing. Tell me if those weren't Republicans, what you would be doing. Have some intellectual honesty here. Care about the people of Minnesota and all the fraud that's happening in this state. And try for just 1 minute to hold people accountable regardless of what their party affiliation is. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Scott. Representative Cagle, briefly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, and this is brief. I think, you know, what I have a problem with is the sincerity of this. And if we're talking about holding people accountable, then it should be a standard across the board. If any single Republican had stood up and said, I think, you know, talking about assaulting women is bad, or, you know, shooting residents in the middle of the street is not what this administration should be doing. maybe taking $500 million planes from Qatar, you know, this pay-to-play system is something that is really happening. And so if I find this completely hypocritical, because you want to apply some standards to some people but not all people. And so if we're talking about holding our leaders accountable, I would pray that you guys would step up and say that what is happening at the federal level is also wrong. And maybe if that were to happen, we would take this a little more seriously, because we see what is happening at the federal level. We see the pay to play. We see the Trump meme coins and how much money the Trumps are making off the presidency. But yet that's all okay. So let's apply this evenly. I would love to hear a single GOPer stand up and say that what the president is doing is wrong, and then maybe I'd believe that this is coming from an honest place.
Representative Cagle, Washington Democrats have pursued impeachment over and over again. Representative Nash.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess my question would be, where does accountability begin here in the state of Minnesota? We swore an oath when we were sworn in as state representatives, and our colleagues in the Senate when they were sworn in as senators, to uphold the laws of the state of Minnesota. We can't impeach anybody in Washington. We don't have that privilege of voting in that chamber of Congress or the Senate. So the question remains, where does accountability begin here in the state of Minnesota? And what I've heard from my colleagues on the DFL side of the aisle today is a deflection away from the things that we've heard. Just continual deflection. Oh, look the other way. We're not going to focus on the fact that Attorney General Ellison has a recording where something is credible enough, and here's the important part, credible enough to move along the process to look into it further. That's the question before us. This is not the impeachment hearing. This is whether it gets moved on to the next station and looked into and ultimately gets transmitted to the Senate. If you are truly interested in exonerating the people who are being looked at today, then move it along. Don't leave it up to just the DFL members log jamming it in the Rules Committee. Recognize that accountability, and I forget, I think it was Representative Coulter said that we need to respect the will of the voters. The voters sent us here to also hold the executive branch accountable if malfeasance happens. That is also the will of the voters, Representative Coulter. We cannot just say, oh, well, this happened, it's in the past, deflect away with federal issues. We have a job that we swore to uphold, that we would hold the executive branch accountable. That is given to us in our duties as legislators. It's an exceptionally important duty that we have, and you should take that duty exceptionally seriously. I think that what you're trying to do is create a furor around not talking about what's actually before us. Did something happen with Keith Ellison? Let's move it along the next step and dig in. Did the governor know and turn a blind eye? Let's send it on and do a full investigation. You're not even willing to do that based on what you're telling me you're going to vote on. So the deflection is really palpable right now. But you swore an oath to look into things. You swore an oath to uphold the Constitution, which gives state representatives and state senators the ability to hold the executive branch accountable. You've heard from Democrats, you've heard from Republicans, you've heard from independents, you've heard from all stripes of Minnesotans that said this is wrong. And when will the legislature step up and do something? You now have that opportunity in front of you. And I would challenge you to take the advice of the people who you represent, who have more than likely filled your inbox or your voicemail box with the request to do something meaningful, not just deflect this away. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Nash. Representative Long, and then we'll proceed to a vote.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, we have 1 month left of session. And instead of focusing on the things that Minnesotans are actually asking us to do, like reduce their cost of living, like deal with gun violence prevention, the Republicans are proposing that we spend that time, the remaining time of session, in partisan attacks. It's not a shock to me that you all want a Republican governor and you all want a Republican attorney general. Well, guess what? The voters will have that opportunity to make that decision in November. But what is shocking to me is that you all want to use the next month that we have available in committee, even on the floor, to spend our time platforming what are basically Republican campaign speeches when we could be using that time to legislate. I get that you all have written off session. You already voted to adjourn early. Your members are leaving to go drink in committee. We have a new vice chair of this committee. But the public is asking us to actually do things that help them. They are facing real economic challenges with cost of living. They are dealing with the aftermath of Operation Metro Surge. They are asking us to take action on gun violence prevention. They are asking us to take action on actual bills that would address fraud. And yet, we are here debating this nonsense. Minnesotans want us to act. We are ready to act. Democrats are ready to do the hard work of compromise, of negotiating, of legislating. Yet we have this embarrassment to the institution that we are actually taking our time to turn what would be the only Republican-chaired committee, chaired by a Republican candidate for governor, into essentially a GOP campaign arm for the rest of the session. So I hope that we can vote this down and get back to the actual work of legislating that we are here to do on behalf of Minnesotans. Mr. Chair, I ask for a roll call.
Roll call has been requested. Well, members, outside of this room, what most Minnesotans are demanding, especially today on tax day, is accountability for the multi-billion dollar fraud scandal that's embarrassing our state. That's what I hear about when I go back in my community, and they expect us to treat this seriously, to have, yes, equal standards, not just Republican and Democrat, but equal standards, public sector and private sector, because in any well-functioning business, a multi-billion dollar fraud scandal would result in the CEO either resigning in disgrace or being fired, and certainly would result in the general counsel or the attorney in charge of that company resigning or in disgrace or being fired. And if we cannot move forward with an investigation about these serious questions, Minnesotans, I expect better. I am not shocked that Democrats do not want to talk about these problems. When I attempted to even discuss one of these problems on the House floor, I was repeatedly interrupted. So it would not shock me if Democrats refuse to move forward with any sort of an investigation. But it is important that when we look at what we can do in the Minnesota House of Representatives, we can't do anything about Donald Trump. We can't do anything about things happening in Washington. I certainly understand why Minnesota Democrats don't want to talk about the policy issues and the policy problems that have been created by all Democrat-controlled government here in the state of Minnesota and want to talk about what's going on with Donald Trump. But when we look at what we can control, what we can do to hold people accountable, to have some accountability for the multi-billion dollar fraud scandal, this is what we can do. So, members, I urge support for the R13A resolution. I renew my motion, and the roll call has been requested. The clerk will take the roll. Chair votes
aye. Mr. Chair, do we get closing statements? Very short.
We're on a roll call vote, Representative Wiener.
Chair Long?
No.
Vice Chair Schultz?
Yes.
Vice Chair Hollins?
No.
Representative Allen?
Yes.
Representative Coulter?
No.
Representative Frederick?
No.
Representative Howard?
No.
Representative Jacob?
Jacob, yes.
Representative Jordan?
No.
Representative Cagle?
No.
Representative Nash?
Yes.
Representative Purcell?
Purcell, no.
Representative Scott?
Yes.
Representative Steer?
Yes.
And Representative Zalesnikar?
Yes.
There being 8 ayes and 8 nays, the motion does not prevail. That concludes our agenda for today. The meeting is adjourned.